Welcome to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. I'm Russ White. Kirk Heinze hosts today.
A heated legislative debate in Lansing is centered on whether to further regulate or deregulate Michigan's electricity market. We'll hear from an energy law expert on why deregulation may be the better option despite what the power utilities are saying. And we'll also learn about an MSU program that helps prepare veterans for the food and agricultural industry.
Visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com.
It's MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR, and we get started at 4:06. Tune to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Kirk Heinze.
Well, throughout the fall and into 2016, there's been a contentious legislative debate regarding the rules that govern competition in Michigan's electricity market. Essentially, the disagreement pits Michigan's two major utilities, DTE Energy and Consumers Energy, against some of their competitors and some of the customers of those competitors. With us to better understand Michigan's energy industry and this particular debate is Bruce Goodman. Bruce is an attorney with the Varnum Law Firm who has over three decades of experience in energy, environmental, and construction law. Bruce, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
First of all, give our listeners an overview of how this whole energy sector works in Michigan's economy.
Okay, be happy to. Michigan, like most other states, has electric utilities that are operated as monopolies. They were authorized 100 years ago. People decided that having electricity come from one source was a good idea, and therefore we have regulated monopolies where the electric utilities are given service territories where they become the exclusive provider. And in exchange for that monopoly, they agree that they can have their rates regulated by the Michigan Public Service Commission. And if they want to change their rates, increase their rates, or reduce their rates, they have to come before the Michigan Public Service Commission and explain the reasons and give the justifications for those requests.
Now, in 2000, there was an attempt by, I think, then-Governor Engler to deregulate, to maybe in essence break up those monopolies. Give us some of that background.
Okay, that's a good point. Well, the electric rates in Michigan in 2000 were the highest in the Midwest, and I think Governor Engler looked around and saw that states that had deregulated the electric area we're seeing lower rates. And so the legislature agreed with him and said that electric customers in Michigan no longer were tied to just one supplier, that they could go to whomever and buy their electricity. It's sort of like the phone company being deregulated in the 1980s, where instead of having Michigan Bell and AT&T as the sole providers for local phone service and for long-distance service, you could go to Sprint or MCI. We now have Verizon. So in 2000, Governor Engler and the legislature deregulated the electric market and let other sellers come in to sell electricity if they could persuade customers to switch over to them. The utilities at the time complained that they had a lot of investment in the state and that if they lost customers, that investment was going to be lost and their shareholders would be very, very unhappy. So the legislature passed a second law that said the utilities were entitled to recover the stranded asset costs, that's the phrase that was used for these assets that might go unused, they could recover that money from their ratepayers over the next 15 years. And so the Michigan Public Service Commission awarded both DTE Energy and Consumers Energy a large sum of money, you know, upwards of $500, $600, $700 million in the case of Consumers Energy, with the prospect that they were going to lose all their customers, and the only service that they would be providing would be carrying the electricity into homes, and the local distribution systems would be the only way they would be recovering funds. So a very complicated step was taken in 2000.
And then from 2000 to 2008, the electric companies lost, correct me if I'm wrong, approximately 10% of their customer base. Why just 10%? I mean, if we have an open market where there's, like you mentioned in the phone industry, there's a competitive price structure, why only 10% of those customers left the two big power providers?
Okay, well, one thing that happened was when deregulation started, all of a sudden DTE Energy and Consumers Energy no longer had the highest rates in the Midwest. Their rates went down so that by 2008, they had the lowest rates in the Midwest. One might say that Governor Engler may have had a pretty good idea.
Had it right.
Yeah. And so when their rates went down, it was a little less attractive for customers to go off and shop around because the other prices weren't nearly as attractive. So it did make the investor-owned utilities in the state respond to market prices. Nonetheless, 10% of the customers found it more advantageous on a strictly economic basis to go off and contract for cheaper electricity. I heard yesterday that one company contracted for 20 years. They froze their electric rates for the next 20 years, and they thought that was going to be a good deal for their future planning.
We're talking energy law with Bruce Goodman, an attorney with the Varnum Law Firm. Bruce is based in Grand Rapids. He has over three decades of experience in energy and environmental law. Okay, Bruce, we talked about the efforts to deregulate in 2000 in the Engler administration. About 10% of the customers left DTE Energy and Consumers. Fast forward to 2008, Granholm's administration is pushing for a renewable energy portfolio. What happened in 2008?
In 2008, there was a battle royal where the utilities were adamant that they would not accept the renewable portfolio standard, the requirement that they acquire some of their energy from renewable resources unless they got something in exchange. And what they wanted in exchange was to get their monopoly back. And I think initially they were asking for all of it, to have 100% of their customers, again, locked into having to buy electricity from the local utility. The compromise was that the 10% of the customers that had migrated off the system were buying power from some other supplier. They were allowed to keep that purchase arrangement, but the other 90% of the customers who hadn't yet left the system, they found themselves locked back in to the regulated utility, the regulated monopoly.
And the trade-off was then the support of the renewable energy portfolio.
Right. Right after that deal was struck, Michigan had a 10% renewable portfolio standard, and the governor had a win, and the state of Michigan had a win because we now have wind farms and solar farms with free fuel for our electricity.
Yeah, 10% by 2015, and there's some talk that we could ramp that up a bit, but that's another topic. So to right now,
yes.
Okay, so there's a 10% cap on the number of folks that can choose electricity from any provider. We had the next soon-to-be CEO of Consumers Energy, Patty Poppe, on the program saying, yeah, we can live with the 10%, but there's some legislation downtown that we don't like right now, which is trying to open it up again. So give us an overview of what's the issue downtown right now.
Okay, well, on that particular issue, there are some legislators who recognize that many customers of, and we'll just stick with consumers' energy, there's about another 10% of the consumers' energy customers who have signed tentative contracts with alternative energy suppliers saying, if we were allowed to choose our electric supplier, we would choose, and then they've named a different company other than Consumers Energy. So if we deregulated the consumers' energy area again, we would expect another 10% would leave their system so that they would only have 80% of the customers that they had at one time. That is one of the issues out there that the utility, both DTE and consumers, are fighting. And it's unclear to me whether they're fighting, you know, let's just keep the 10% that we agreed to back in 2008, or whether they really want to say, no, we want it all back. We want to squeeze that 10% back onto our system. And there are a number of ways that have been proposed where it's going to be much less attractive to be part of that 10%. And that's part of what's holding up the current energy legislation, is that battle in terms of how much of the marketplace will be regulated monopoly and how much of it will be free enterprise.
I don't want to put words in her mouth, but in essence, one of the arguments that consumers voiced was that if these 10% of folks who are choice customers decide for some reason or another over time or all at one time, which is unlikely, to come back to consumers, consumers is obligated by law to provide the service to those customers, so they need the infrastructure to do that. So we, the 90%, are in essence subsidizing the 10% if they were to come back into the system.
Well, I'm not sure what Patty Poppe was thinking when she was saying that, but I can guess at some of the arguments. Certainly, if Consumers Energy had a lot more customers, they would need more generation. Either they would need to build it themselves, and they love to build it themselves because they're entitled to a 10% profit on whatever they build, or they could go off into the marketplace and they could buy the electricity from an adjacent utility or an adjacent supplier, of which there are many. In fact, there's an excess of supply in the Midwest. However, if they bought that energy, they have to resell it at the price that they purchased it. So they don't earn any profit on purchased energy, and that's where the complication comes in, because yes, it may be true that if you have to build a power plant, it's going to be more expensive to build a brand new power plant. But if you buy the energy, it's not going to be any more expensive. You're going to buy it from power plants that are already built.
But if I'm reading you rightly, they can make money on building new infrastructure, but they can't make money just going on the energy market and brokering that energy.
That's right. That's one of the oddities of being a regulated utility, is you make money when you build things. And in fact, most recently, Consumers was entitled to a 10% profit on the construction of their wind farms. However, if they purchase energy, they cannot earn any profit on that. So their shareholders obviously want them to be building.
Okay, this is doing a good job of breaking this down, but given what's going on downtown, you're monitoring the legislation. I know that there are some conditions that are there's some legislation that will put further conditions on the 10% of the people who are the choice folks. What's going to happen, in your opinion, with the legislation downtown?
I think the legislation is not going to move. I think that we're into an election year, and the opportunity to come up with some meaningful energy legislation really diminished as we turn the calendar over. Plus, we see a governor who's distracted by a lot of other issues. He was
major
really,
issue distraction. Yes.
Yes, he was really taking the lead, and had his staff working. The other thing that's happened is the Clean Power Plan has now been suspended by the U.S. Supreme Court, and that was a driving force for Michigan to act on a new energy policy. And so all those factors suggest to me that nothing's going to happen. We're going to stay at 10% choice customers. We're going to stay at 10% renewable energy portfolio, and energy efficiency will continue at, I think it's 1% per year ad infinitum until we get a new energy bill.
And last thing, too, and just a comment, and again, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but obviously referring back to what happened after Engler tried to deregulate, the competition did, in fact, lower the prices of electricity. And Michigan still, though, now back up there, remains one of the more expensive states in the Midwest. Is that true?
Since 2008, Michigan went from being the lowest energy rates in the Midwest to being among the highest once again. You know, the Michigan Public Service Commission is supposed to come up with an electric price that approximates what the competitive market would provide, and it just doesn't work as well as real competition.
My guest is Bruce Goodman. He's an attorney with the Varnum Law Firm, an expert in energy and environmental law. Bruce, we talked energy today, but I'd love to have you back on the program talking about some of your work in environmental law as well.
I'd love to come back and talk to you again. Thank you.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with a sustainability-focused Greening of the Great Lakes segment inside MSU Today here on AM 870 WKAR. To read Kirk's blog and hear more Greening of the Great Lakes content, visit mlive.com/environment. Tune to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's more with Kirk Heinze.
The program at MSU is called Conservation Criminology, and it is the only one on the globe. Here to tell us about conservation criminology and her own work is Dr. Meredith Gore. Dr. Gore is an associate professor in both the Department of Fisheries and Wildlife and the School of Criminal Justice at Michigan State University. Her work is funded in part by MSU Ag Bio Research, and she was recently named a very prestigious National Academies of Science Jefferson Science Fellow. Meredith, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Conservation criminology. Pardon the alliteration, I mean, but captivating concept, compelling. Tell us what it is.
Sure. Well, in 2008, when I started my faculty position here, a group of faculty in both the Department of Fisheries and Wildlife, School of Criminal Justice, and also Environmental Science and Policy program, so all across campus, we got together and we started thinking about how can we begin to have research, teaching, and sort of outreach all related to environmental harms. And so we thought we can leverage MSU's sort of capacity for interdisciplinary scholarship and start trying to direct attention to this. And so we called it conservation criminology. So we borrow from the disciplines of natural resource policy and management, criminology and criminal justice, and also risk and decision science.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And in addition to your doctoral work, but I noticed that your undergraduate work was in anthropology. So you've got a whole dimension of forensic anthropology at play here. But so our listeners are clear, what are some of those, you call them illegal, illicit, and devious human behaviors that we're talking about here?
Sure. So fundamentally, we're looking at human relationships with the environment and environmental harm. So some of the research and teaching and sort of service that I'm doing focuses on wildlife poaching. So we think of sort of the very sort of dramatic, violent elephant and rhino poaching that's going on. But we also have some of this affecting the state of Michigan. We've had turtles and tortoises smuggled in through the border in Sarnia from Canada. So, and there are issues here in the United States as well. So some of us do work on wildlife poaching. I have a colleague, Dr. Carol Gibbs, who does work on illegal trade in electronic waste, which is a huge global environmental justice issue. We have faculty that are doing work on fish fraud, so fraudulent labeling of fish for consumption in our supermarkets, fraudulent carbon credit trading. So there's a lot of really diverse issues, unfortunately, that can, I think, be kind of enveloped under this concept.
Well, the poaching and the smuggling resonate, and a lot of that, I mean, give credit to publications like National Geographic for drawing attention to that sort of a thing. But specifically, what can your research do? I mean, these people are doing it, obviously, for financial gain, even though it's criminal, and they're willing to take those risks. What can your research do to help alleviate this problem?
So I think that's a really good question. Wildlife poaching and use of wildlife has been going on since the time of Marco Polo. So this is not a new issue. But the violence, the scale, the globalization, the dimensions of globalization, and then also this presumed connection between insecurity and the fact that these wildlife parts are now potentially being used to finance terrorism has really helped to elevate this issue to the global high policy agenda. So in 2013, President Obama issued the executive order on wildlife trafficking. I don't think that was the technical term. But so now we have a U.S. strategy on wildlife trafficking. And so globally, we have a lot more attention to this on this issue. So how can conservation criminology help? Well, we're bringing interdisciplinary ways of thinking about this idea. We're kind of pushing the boundary on ways to think about the problem, diagnose the problem, see the picture. There are also new strategies and opportunities for potentially resolving some of these negative effects on people and wildlife. So we're trying to work with all sorts of different stakeholder groups. So in Michigan, we work with Michigan Department of Natural Resources. I work with civil society groups in Madagascar. I work with, U.S. government officials. There are all sorts of different levels of stakeholders that can be brought into the conversation, and we can start to try to address this in a really proactive and not only reactive way.
I want to come back to your work in Michigan and with gray wolves because, as you know, that's hot in the news here.
Absolutely.
Locally. But in terms of the international part that we've been talking about, what about options for some of these poachers to do things other than poaching and illegal activities in order to sustain some kind of a livelihood? I mean, is that part of what you folks are doing?
Absolutely. So one way that you can think about this issue is kind of like the small scale folks that are doing this. And in academia, we call this the protein deficiency hypothesis, right? So people lack protein, and so they're exploiting wildlife to either feed themselves directly or sell in a market so that they can get. So that is a phenomenon that can be addressed by sort of community-based wildlife management. And that's very low level. And that's kind of the exploitation that's been going on for some time. It's this high level organized crime, really violent, heavily armed, essentially militarized exploitation of wildlife that's really starting to be the high policy priority. And so thinking about new regulations that can be included, like, getting some of these individuals prosecuted under the RICO acts in the United States, things like that. So there's different levels of and scale. And so one of the things that conservation criminology does and that I've been doing is trying to think about the ways that we can scale these strategies, scale them up to the sort of really high level, and then also scale them down.
My guest is Meredith Gore. She's a professor at Michigan State University in Fisheries and Wildlife and the School of Criminal Justice. She was recently named a National Academies of Science Jefferson Science Fellow. Meredith, we talked about some of the issues with poaching and smuggling internationally. Let's come back to an issue you've worked on right here in Michigan. That's the whole gray wolf matter. A lot of science on both sides of that issue. What should we do? Should we hunt them? Should we cull them? Should we relocate them? What is your research?
So my research for gray wolves in Michigan has focused on the human dimensions, right? So Michigan has a very long tradition of biological, sort of doing research on the biological side of wolves and wolf management. That's not my area of expertise. So trying to my work has kind of, I guess, been threefold. So first, I've been exploring sort of general public opinion about some of the issues that can be on wildlife managers' radar screens. What are some of the things that are important to managers? So, for example, wolf-dog hybrids is something that a lot of biologists are very concerned about. Not an issue that I hear a lot of sort of Michiganders talking about. But wolf hunting, stakeholder engagement in the decision-making process, those are things that people do talk about. So I've been working with graduate students to do work on sort of public opinion on wolves. I've also done some work on the Isle Royale wolf situation where you have this idea of genetic rescue. So a very long tradition, again, of biological science being going on Isle Royale. And as the wolf population has dwindled, there's a policy choice, right? Do we genetically rescue or not genetically rescue this population? And so what some of the work that I have done involves looking at public comments and exploring the ways that different individuals are either supporting or opposing this idea of genetic rescue, and kind of the arguments and attitudes that kind of underlie why people might support or oppose a policy.
So that's interesting. So what are you finding? Are these attitudes and perceptions that you're getting from people based largely on science, or are they based on values? Are they based on some combination thereof?
So I think that's a really good question. And I think that we were really, so my collaborators and I were very interested to find that there is not a binary sort of calculus going on in people's heads, sort of yes or no. But it's a mixture of some people are really thinking about the consequences of the actions, and sort of, you know, some people think about the fact that, you know, some people say that this is just a natural event, and so humans shouldn't intervene. Some people think that this is you know, God's kind of or some sort of like divine intervention, and this is just kind of the way things are. And so one of the things that we've thought about is, you know, we can segment stakeholders, pro hunters, anti hunters, you know, pro wolf, anti wolf. But what happens if you start to segment stakeholders according to their values? And is that a new way of bringing people to the table and facilitating dialogue about an issue that can maybe result in more sustainable decisions? So again, what we found was it's actually quite diverse. Public opinion about this issue is quite diverse, and the values underlying their arguments are more diverse than we thought. So I think that's been a very well-received study, and I think has provoked thinking about new ways of engaging stakeholders in wolf decision-making.
That's consistent with some other guests we've had on the program who've looked at this whole issue. How do you talk about science, particularly controversial science issues like climate change, if you've got people in the room who are sort of polar opposites, and what they keep saying is, it's really not the science so much as it is the values.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So this work actually quantified the values underlying either support or opposition to this policy choice of genetic rescue.
We're talking about conservation criminology and some research in that area with Meredith Gore, an MSU professor of fisheries and wildlife and criminal justice. Meredith, you have students who are doing things all over the world.
I do.
And I know you're traveling a lot in addition to doing things in the United States. But a little bit about graduate students in this area, and, you know, is this a growing field? Are you getting international students involved in this? A little bit about that cadre.
Sure. I love my lab. My graduate students are really pushing the boundaries of sort of my thinking, and I think thinking in conservation criminology. So, sure, I have a student who just left 2 weeks ago who's doing a joint MS and JD here at MSU. He received a Fulbright Fellowship. He's doing work on compliance and inland fisheries management in the Pantanal region of Brazil. I have another student, Mark Gibson, who's a PhD student in criminal justice. He's doing work on green turtle and spiny lobster fisheries in the Caribbean coast of Nicaragua. Jessica Kaler received National Science Foundation funding to do work on rhino and elephant poaching in Indonesia. I have another student, Rachel Barado, who's a PhD student doing work on, this is super cool, urban bushmeat consumption in Pointe Noire in Congo. So that's this idea of urban bushmeat consumption is very new for conservation criminology. Yeah, so we're and then I have a student, Ronak Sripal, doing work here in Michigan on exploitation of fur bearers. So we're all over the world.
You know, it used to be back in the day when people would talk about conservation, you would think conservation officer for the Department of Natural Resources or for the U.S. Forest Service or something of that nature. This opens up a whole new dimension in that area, people who are interested in diversity and wildlife preservation.
Absolutely. So the question is, where do we go when so my students are on, some of them are on trajectories to go into academia. Some of them are really interested in working for conservation organizations, and others are interested in government, you know, like a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service or, working for the State Department, Foreign Service, or even, you know, a job like in the U.N. And then I have a couple that are interested in forming non-governmental organizations in the countries in which they're doing research.
Meredith, we just got about a minute or so left here, but in this whole area, because it is so emotionally driven with the poaching and the smuggling and back to those sorts of things, as you put on sort of your more philosophical hat, I imagine there are some success stories around the world that you could point to, probably somewhat limited, but where is this all going?
You had a success story? Mm-hmm. Where is it all going? I am inspired by seeing new collaborations. So I see new partnerships between industry and government. I see new partnerships between non-governmental organizations. I see civil society groups becoming more and more involved in this issue. And so I think this is a really messy problem. And I think that by bringing in many, many different stakeholders and getting individuals to work collectively on the problem, I get inspired that that's going to ultimately lead to sort of solutions, which is to really reduce the risks on both humans and environment and wildlife. So That's where I remain inspired. But we have a lot of work to do. And unfortunately, I think that there are a lot of wildlife species that are really in jeopardy from this issue.
Yeah, and the thing that, I mean, the example of your work where you're bringing the social sciences and the humanities to bear on what is also a scientific problem, understanding motivations and behaviors that cause this sort of illicit activity is extremely important to mitigating the problem.
I agree, and I think that it allows us to think about the problem more holistically. And I'm hopeful that that will then lead in more sustainable solutions.
Well, I know you're probably going to be traveling again soon. You do all over the globe. But Meredith, thanks so much for making time to do this interview. I've been talking with Dr. Meredith Gore. She's an associate professor in fisheries and wildlife and the School of Criminal Justice at Michigan State University. Her work is supported in part by our good friends at MSU Ag BioResearch. Meredith, thanks so much for being on Greening the Great Lakes.
Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with a sustainability-focused Greening of the Great Lakes segment inside MSU Today here on AM 870 WKAR. To read Kirk's blog and hear more Greening of the Great Lakes content, visit mlive.com/environment.
Well, here in studio to talk to us about an extremely innovative program that not only helps our honored veterans, but does so in a way that helps ensure the sustainability of our food system. The program is called, appropriately enough, Vets to Ag. Vets to Ag. And here to tell us about it are Tom Smith. Tom is the Associate Director of the Institute of Agricultural Technology at MSU. And Nick Babcock, a proud veteran and senior majoring in animal science at MSU. Tom, great to see you.
Thank you, Kirk. It's great to be here and appreciate the opportunity to talk about what we're doing to serve veterans and also help out the food and agricultural industry in Michigan.
And Nick, it's an honor to welcome you to the program.
Thank you. It's a real privilege to be here today.
Tom, before we get into the Vets to Ag, tell us a little bit about the Institute of Ag Technology, some of your programs, the mission, sort of a unique mission in the state of Michigan.
It really is, Kirk, and it has a long history. The Institute dates back to 1894, And it was a recognition by what was then Michigan Agricultural College that not everyone was going to come to East Lansing for and spend 4 years getting an education. So they developed a series of short courses geared towards farmers, and that really mission continues today. It became the Institute in 1967, and the whole idea is to, again, identify very hands-on, technical-based programs that could serve the state of Michigan. We have 9 programs on campus that range anywhere from 18 months to 2 years in length. They're very focused, but the students are MSU students. They're here, they're living in the dorms, they're going to sporting events. They're really no different than a 4-year student, other than their program is very different. We also have a number of programs and continues to grow in partnership with community colleges. That mission, again, continues. Not everyone can come to campus, so we have reached out to those students throughout the state in partnership with community colleges, identified programs that meet the local needs, and then offer those programs and deliver them right at that local level. MSU courses are delivered at the community college.
One of the benchmarks of your programs has always been a lot of practical application. I mean, these students are out doing internships, they're doing shadow programs. I mean, they're really involved in the discipline or in the profession they're preparing for.
Most definitely, and our industry partners are a key to that. We want to give them hands-on experience, and in fact, to finish that program, they're required to do a 450-hour internship. Those are, for the most part, paid internships with industry all over Michigan, but also all over the country.
Well, speaking of innovative programs that really fulfill mission, the Vets to Ag program, what a wonderful concept. Give us an overview of the Vets to Ag program.
Be happy to do that, Kirk. First of all, it does meet the mission. Michigan State is a land-grant institution. We serve all the peoples of Michigan, not just those that have the ability to come here for 4 years. It's a great idea, but it wasn't our idea. It was brought to us back in 2009 by the Veteran Services Division of the Michigan Workforce Development Agency, and now that is the Veteran Employment Services. So they came to us with a great idea. Could we work with them to develop and deliver programs to serve veterans, especially veterans that have significant barriers to employment? So we began by serving veterans that were homeless. It has expanded, but we still keep that mission in place with the program. And we have done a number of programs over the years since 2009. They range everything from meat cutting and processing to today we're doing a program in food production, processing, and distribution focused on Southeast Michigan.
Well, let's talk to one of the vets, Nick Babcock, who's a senior majoring in animal science at Michigan State. Nick, you've been very helpful in getting this program launched at Michigan State. You've been very much involved in it. Tell us a little bit about why you got involved and the impact this program has.
Absolutely. Thank you. Well, what really brought me here to Michigan State was I retired from the Army in 2013. And I like to always say that my wife told me I was too young to stay home and be retired. So I ended up coming to Michigan State, where I'm an animal science major here, and I'll be graduating this May. But through that, when I came to MSU in 2013, I got involved with the Student Veterans of America, the MSU chapter. And that's really what started the process, where I met Tom, and I was able to partake in that cohort back in 2014, the meat processing cohort that was taking place here at Michigan State University.
Well, the meat processing is one dimension of the program. What are some of the other areas that vets can receive training in?
Absolutely. Well, you know, just even what we have to offer through the Vets to Ag program can, I mean, we really can tailor it to industry needs. So it's really an open door. We're not locked into a specific lane that we have to stick to. But as we see anything that comes up, or even the industry can come to us and explain, hey, we think we have a need that's agriculture based within the state of Michigan, and we can get a hold of Tom and get a hold of me, and we can really work in a specific cohort that will help fill that needs that maybe the industry sees, as well as helping our veterans and the state of Michigan.
You know, Nick, one thing in my involvement in the agricultural industry, a lot of people outside the industry don't know that we have had some workforce problems in terms of finding people for these jobs. How do you get the message out to veterans that these opportunities exist, particularly veterans who may not have a whole lot of background in agriculture and food?
Absolutely. Well, first, I think it really comes down to our partnerships. It's not any one voice or any one entity. I mean, we can do it through Michigan State University, but it really takes those partners, the partners that we've created through the Workforce Development Agency down in Detroit, the partnerships that we have through the VA, and then through the Michigan Works Office, through the Veterans Affairs Division. And those are really what helps us get the word out, because we're such a small we have such a small target population. We can really, you know, magnify that by really working out and branching with all the different organizations that we partner with.
And what are some of the anecdotal things you've heard from some of your fellow vets who have been through some of these programs? I imagine the feedback is, you know, come fairly quickly and is, I would imagine, quite positive.
Absolutely. And I think really the most unique thing about it all is it really brings back the values that the military has instilled in us. You know, it's really that sense, especially when we look at our cohorts, when we actually bring veterans together and they really get back to that sense of what a lot of us really come to love and admire through our military service, that it doesn't matter our background, it doesn't matter where we came from, that we can come together and we can work together to meet a task.
Tom, let's come back to you in terms of some of the upcoming opportunities in the program. I mean, there might be some vets listening to this broadcast. Hopefully there are. What are some of the things that are on the horizon that folks can get involved in?
Well, we've been very fortunate with the current program that we're doing. It's actually a grant through the Michigan Department of Agriculture and Rural Development, and the grant is to Hopeful Harvest, which is the social enterprise of Forgotten Harvest in Southeast Michigan. And they, of course, do food collection and redistribution. We also have another great partner, Southwest Solutions, who, as Nick said, is doing a lot of the case management for the veterans and non-veterans, because this is not exclusive to veterans. We have two more cohorts available, the next one starting May 2nd. This is a 13-week program. So the programs that we do are very intense. Up until this point, they've all been residential, so we have provided food and lodging, and most of those programs have been 6 weeks in length. But when we look at the amount of contact time that veterans are getting, it's equivalent to a student at Michigan State taking an entire semester with a 16-credit load. So in 6 weeks, we're going 5 days a week with study time in the evening, study time in the afternoon. This program now, 13 weeks, includes 4 weeks of job readiness, where they brush up on reading and math skills. They also work on resume, their presentation to employers. We bring employers in to meet with them. And so really, it's a great opportunity for employers to, in essence, road test a potential employee. We also embed industry-recognized credentials. So with the food area, food production, processing, distribution, and even with the meat cutting and processing, we do things like HACCP training, hazard analysis critical control point training, and certification. They get ServSafe, which is the food handling. They get Red Cross training. They get pesticide certification. So they come out after that 6 week or 13 week program with not only the technical training and hands-on skills, but they come out with these industry recognized credentials. So we'll go another year and about another half a year with this food production, processing, and distribution. But we're always looking for other opportunities. We're exploring developing a veteran corps to battle invasive species around the state, and there's quite a bit of interest in that. We'll probably do another food or another meat cutting and processing program. So as Nick said, we really can customize these to where the industry needs are.
Tom, we could talk about this all day, but we've got to wrap up the interview. Where can people get more information about these programs?
Well, they can certainly contact me. My email is fairly easy, smitht48@msu.edu. smitht48@msu.edu. I'll even give my phone number, 517-353-4822. They can also Google the website for Institute of Agricultural Technology. They can get a hold of Nick. Nick, you want to give your information out?
Sure, absolutely. You can contact me through the Student Veterans of America website or through our email, which is msusva@msu.edu.
We've been talking about the fantastic Vets to Ag program with Tom Smith. He's the Associate Director of the Institute of Agricultural Technology at Michigan State. And Nick Babcock, a proud veteran of the U.S. Army, a senior majoring in the Animal Science program at Michigan State, and very much involved in Vets to Ag and all veterans, all things veterans at Michigan State University. Thanks both of you for being on the program.
Thank you, Kirk.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with a sustainability-focused Greening of the Great Lakes segment inside MSU Today here on AM 870 WKAR. To read Kirk's blog and hear more Greening of the Great Lakes content, visit mlive.com/environment. I'm Russ White for Greening of the Great Lakes. Michigan State University alumnus Mark Shupan is CEO of Shupan & Sons. You may be most familiar with the company's Shupan Recycling Division, as their green recycling bins are prevalent at Spartan Athletics venues.
Well, our partnership with Michigan State is, in the beginning, we got pretty much involved in helping them to establish a greater recycling program, especially for during the game day. And as time went on, they've grown nicely. And for us, it has been a true partnership. A lot of things that we do for schools around the state to promote recycling are more because it's the right thing to do. The economics sometimes aren't always there, but that part of our business has also grown greatly in the last few years.
While there are ups and downs in the commodities markets, Shupan believes recycling is important and the right thing to do.
Well, I feel fortunate that a large part of our business is in the recycling area because, you know, we have one planet here, and the idea, if we can recycle and we can do the best we can to make sure that instead of waste, that we have new products to be made out of things, we're doing this. There's a saying that once we had some T-shirts, it's basically more or less the Earth does not belong to us; we belong to Earth. That's Chief C. Allen, and I truly feel that. Well, there was another saying, and I'm not sure if I can remember, was basically is we don't inherit the earth, we borrow it from our children, so we have to continue to do the right things.
Shupan's recycling division may be the most visible part of the company, but there's a lot more to Shupan & Sons.
We have our roots, which is the industrial recycling, where we handle close to 700 industrial plants. We handle their metal. We're aluminum specialists. We're in Indiana, Ohio, Michigan. We buy material from all over the country. Aluminum is really our specialty. We have that division with operations in Elkhart and a number of plants in Kalamazoo. Our distribution and manufacturing we have two plants in Ohio and one in Kalamazoo. And almost 30% of everything that we distribute, primarily aluminum plastics, is value added. So we make some parts for medical, automotive, the office furniture, some pretty sophisticated things there. We are very much involved in the deposit environment for Michigan. We have two plants, and we have a pickup service for over 600 stores, and we are every day handling PET, aluminum, and glass. And so that keeps us busy. We also have, in the last few years, we bought an electronics recycling operation, which is growing by leaps and bounds. And I'm partners in a melting operation in Wabash, Indiana, for aluminum. So we got a lot of different things going on every day, that's for sure.
The challenges facing Shupan & Sons?
Well, the challenges today is we're in a world market. What happens in China certainly affects us on a daily basis. The environment from a standpoint of the cost to do business today, the idea is how do you attract the best people? We have a saying, nobody ever washes a rental car. And what that means to us is we don't want one job at Shupan & Sons that's a rental job. If people own their own jobs, they really do a good job taking care of them. And that's the environment that we wish to promote.
Giving back to the community is important to Mark Shupan.
Well, one of the things I always talk about, I do get a chance to speak sometimes, is the difference between significance and success. And a lot of times success has been judged by what is your car, what is the size of your house, what is your bank book that people think you have. Where significance is, does your life actually make a difference in the lives of others? And my mother used to say it's easier to give somebody the shirt off your back if you happen to have another one. But she also had a philosophy that if we were ever successful, or even reasonably successful, that we needed to give back to our to the communities. And so we have tried certainly to do that. People know actually the Big Brothers and Big Sisters in Kalamazoo is named after a son that we lost 13 years ago. And I've been involved with them for over 30 years. So, and there's just a number of things that we do in the community, and because we think it makes it a better place.
Mark Shupan's advice for today's young people involves finding balance in your life and making sure you give as well as take.
Well, I guess my advice to people is to find something that you enjoy. There would be nothing worse is to go to a job day in and day out that you really do not like. Now, sometimes you have to pay your dues a little bit, but try to follow your interest and your dreams. Find companies to work for that absolutely do care about their people and that will help you grow. There has to be a balance in your life, and you also have to know that whatever you do, it's important not just to take but to give back and to be in an environment with companies that you feel good about that actually do help society. And it's just not a one-sided way of doing business.
There's more on Shupan and Sons at Shupan.com. That's S-C-H-U-P-A-N, Shupan.com. I'm Russ White for Greening of the Great Lakes.
MSU AgBio Research is really centered around leading research and developing scientific discoveries in the areas of food, energy, and environment.
Doug Bueller leads MSU AgBio Research.
Our history bases us in Michigan, but we've really expanded that mission to the nation and to the world.
MSU AgBio Research has more than 300 scientists representing 7 MSU colleges.
We're very interested in continuing to build international linkages because of the importance of what we do and the global nature of agriculture and the global nature of a lot of the problems that we currently face.
MSU AgBio Research is leading research and scientific discoveries in the areas of food, energy, and the environment in Michigan, the nation, and around the world.
The core is that we do research on food, energy, and agriculture. The reality is that those three things are important to everybody every day of their life.
Visit agbioresearch.msu.edu.
Recycle Michigan, a place where there's no city limit, no boundaries, and the population, 9.9 million. So where is Recycle Michigan? It's located in your home, next door, down the road, in your very own community. In their continued effort to increase recycling awareness, the Michigan Recycling Coalition has launched the statewide Recycle Michigan campaign. Serving as a resource to both businesses and residents, the Michigan Recycling Coalition provides simple steps to reduce waste, create awareness of the benefits of recycling, and to discover options for recycling through your local communities. By recycling, you, your family, your neighbors, and your community can help protect the things we love most about our state. Recycling junk mail, water bottles, and other containers will help keep our Great Lakes State clean, but it also promotes job growth in Michigan. Discover how you can become a citizen of Recycle Michigan by exploring MichiganRecycles.org.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear this show again, click on the radio tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.